history of society in this country by distinguishing people, public and masses, and by giving the leadership of people in the churches of this country to the 18th century, and with the development of a public and a secular government as a task of the 19th, and today the problem of corporations and boards of government or corporations as our own problem in the days of a split atom and a split individual, of schizophrenia. So that in order to understand the history of society, it is not legitimate always to talk as though society was composed of the same elements of individuals, but it is composed in a constant shift of a Trinitarian mankind that is half or one third involved in living in families, one half involved in emphasizing its own individuality, and one third entrenched in making a living, in producing the goods of this earth, which cannot be done either by individuals or by families simply, but must be done by the process of production, which is in every time very different indeed, and therefore has no constant principle of organization that is always changing. We went back then and saw how the people, feeling threatened by the development of the secular state, tried to remain the people in their church and how they couldn't do it. We were involved last time, as you know, in giving this strange story of Mormonism, the most American story of all these religious struggles, because it was based on the assumption that there was a new religion for the whole continent of America, for the Aborigines, or already given to the Aborigines, and it is the one truly American religion. It was based on several very strange assumptions. One, that all the churches had apostatized, and that there was no church left except now this new one, the new dispensation of the Latter-day Saints. I brought you, because it is, I think, quite important to document these sayings, I brought you the speech, the discourse of Brigham Young, the heir of the prophet Joseph Smith, the speech which he gave at the dedication of Salt Lake Temple. It isn't usual that we people today in history write and turn to the official documents of inaugurations or solemnifications or however you call it. I think the other way around, I think these very official documents are the best documents to know what really happens, and not the behind the scenes revelations of bosses and this detective story business is not for me. The story is usually quite open, and I'm not believing in these deep secrets. Addressed at the laying of the cornerstone of the Salt Lake City, and I think it's for some of you perhaps quite useful to know that the Mormons themselves printed this. Discourse of Brigham Young, second president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Deseret Book Company, Salt Lake City, Utah, printed in 1925. Now on page 636 there occurs this very bold paragraph. Soon after the ascension of Jesus, that is at Pentecost, and ascension, since the two words ascension and Pentecost, as I have found out to my dismay, no longer are known to many of you. Pentecost or Whitsun Day is the 50th day after Easter, and is the day on which the Holy Spirit conquered the followers of Jesus, who, as you know, in his lifetime had not understood what he was after. Soon after the ascension of Jesus, through mobocracy, martyrdom and apostasy, the Church of Christ became extinct from the earth. The man child, the holy priesthood, was received up into heaven from whence it came, and we hear no more of it on the earth until the angels restored it to Joseph Smith by whose ministry the Church of Christ, Jesus Christ, was restored, reorganized on earth 23 years ago this day, with the title of Latter-day Saints to distinguish them from the former-day saints. Now you see that's quite a bold postulate. And here, this explains to you, however, the reason why the Mormons are, to this day, the most American and the most radical heresy of Christianity. They abolish everything between Paul and Joseph Smith. That's all wrong. That's all abuse. And they say that the gospel has already been revealed 500 years ago to the aboriginous people in this country and has only been hidden. The importance of this is that therefore Joseph Smith was able to find the true gospel on this bleak beach of America. The second thing we have to stress is the persecution. I told you that the strange story of the success of Muhammad and Islam as well as of Joseph Smith is the anticipation of the persecution. Knowing that the things of the Spirit have to be achieved by persecution or entail or produce, provoke persecution. As far as I can read the story of Joseph Smith, his genius is in that he provoked the persecution before it was, so to speak, there, that he began with being persecuted. And the greatest fact of this is that he made known the revelation of the Book of Mormon, then accepted the ensuing slander, persecution, scorn, injury, and after this had worn off, only translated the book and published it. That is a diplomacy or tactics or strategy of the first order, so that the persecution could not ruin the case, not being allowed to come after the event, but being invited to run its course before the event. I have another document which I think we may have time to go into, because it shows the tragedy of all religious movements in a settled and a secular or secularly organized country. These are the minutes of a public meeting at Liberty, Missouri at the time before the Mormons tried to transfer their property and their quarters from Missouri to Illinois, where Joseph Smith then later perished. June 1836 we are, and here's what happened. I think it's very touching. On the 29th of June, a respectable number of the citizens, being previously notified of the meeting, met at the courthouse in the town of Liberty, Missouri. They appointed a committee of nine. We don't have to go into the details of the names. And then they came back with the following unanimous report, which was read. Report. It is apparent to every reflecting mind that the crisis has arisen in this country that requires a deep, cool, dispassionate consideration and immediate action of every lover of peace, harmony, and good order. We cannot conceal from ourselves the fact that at this moment the clouds of civil war are rolling up their fearful masses and hanging over our devoted country, solemn, dark, and terrible. This painful state of things has been produced mainly by the rapid and increasing emigration of that people, commonly called Mormons, during the last few months. It is known to all that in November 1833, these people were expelled from their homes in Jackson County without money, without property, without the means of subsistence for themselves, their wives, and their children, and like Noah's dove, without a resting place for their feet. They came to our county thus friendless and penniless, seeking, as they said, but a temporary asylum from the storm of persecution by which they were then buffeted. Their destitute and miserable condition at that inclement season of the year excited the deep sympathies of the philanthropic and hospitable citizens of this county. And notwithstanding the thousands of reports that were borne on the wings of the wind, charging them with almost every crime known to the laws of our country, yet our feelings of kindness and sympathy for human suffering prevailed over every obstacle, and they were received with friendship and treated with toleration, and often with remarks of peculiar kindness. They always declared that they looked not upon this county as their home, but as a temporary asylum, and that whenever a respectable portion of the citizens of this county should request it, they would promptly leave us in peace as they found us. That period has now arrived. Duty to ourselves, to our families, and to the best interests of our country require at our hands to demand the fulfillment of that pledge. They are charged by those who are opposed to them with an unfriendly determination to violate that pledge. Their rapid immigration, their large purchases of land, of course, and offers to purchase lands, the remarks of the ignorant and imprudent portion of them that this country is destined by heaven to be theirs, are received and looked upon by a large portion of our community as strong and convincing proofs that they intend to make this county their permanent home, the center and general rendezvous of their people. These are some of the reasons why these people have become objects of the deepest hatred and detestation to many of our citizens. They are Eastern men whose manners, habits, customs, and even dialect are essentially different from our own. They are non-slaveholders. Listen to this. They are non-slaveholders and opposed to slavery, which in this peculiar period when abolitionism has reared its deformed and haggard visage in our land is well calculated to excite deep and abiding prejudices in any community where slavery is tolerated and protected. In addition to all this, they are charged, as they have hitherto been, with keeping up a constant communication with our Indian tribes on our frontiers, with declaring even from the pulpit that the Indians are a part of God's chosen people and are destined by heaven to inherit this land in common with themselves. Here you see, of course, the necessity of this Aboriginal gospel to be comprehensive, to include the newcomers from Europe, the New Englanders who emigrate, and the Red Indians out in the West. We do not vouch for the correctness of these statements. That's also very interesting. We do not vouch for the correctness of these statements, but whether they are true or false, the effect has been the same in exciting our community. In times of greater tranquility, such ridiculous remarks might well be regarded as the offspring of frenzied fanaticism. But at this time, our defenseless situation on the frontier, the bloody disasters of our fellow citizens in Florida and other parts of the South, all tend to make a portion of our citizens regard such sentiments with horror, if not alarm. These and many other causes have combined to raise a prejudice against them and a feeling of hostility that the first spark may, and we deeply fear will, ignite into all the horrors and desolations of a civil war, the worst evil that can befall any country. We therefore feel it our duty to come forward as mediators and use every means in our power to prevent the occurrence of so great an evil. As the most efficacious means to arrest the evil, we urge on the Mormons to use every means to put an immediate stop to the immigration of their people to this county. We earnestly urge them to seek some other abiding place where the manners, the habits, and customs of the people will be more consonant with their own. For this purpose, we would advise them to explore the territory of Wisconsin. This country is peculiarly suited. Who is from Wisconsin? Anybody? Nobody from Wisconsin. Who is from Iowa? The migration has stopped. Wisconsin is peculiarly suited to their conditions and their wants. It is. If you kindly will listen to this as an eternal example of the problem of religious and secular forms of life, because this is nothing accidental. This is not the Mormons, and this is not the county of Missouri, Liberty, Missouri. This is the eternal story. You can read it in the Old Testament, you can read it in the New Testament, and read it in the religious history of Islam. Now you read it here. Only when you see that this is not an American problem, but a problem that happens in America because of the clash between people and public, between voters and families, between creeds and opinions, Can you see that the public spirit, which is a strange adulteration between spirit and opinion, will always be torn by having proposed a new way of life to them? And this you must, therefore, I think the document should be placarded. It is hidden now in a never-read book, History of the Church of Christ Latter Day Saints. Here you have one, History of Joseph Smith the Prophet by himself, Volume 2, 1904, came out on page 448 to page 452. So if you ever deal with religious propositions, some of you may even go as far as becoming ministers or adult education men or teachers, turn to this document and you have an example of something that goes through the ages. Now, a recommendation of Wisconsin. It is a territory in which slavery is prohibited, etc. The religious tenets of these people are so different from the present churches of the age that they always have and always will excite deep prejudices against them in any populous country where they may locate. We, therefore, in a spirit of frank and friendly kindness, do advise them to seek a home where they may obtain large and separate whole bodies of land and have a community of their own. We further they to say to them, if they regard their own safety and welfare, if they regard the welfare of their families, their wives and children, they will ponder with deep and solemn reflection on this friendly admonition. If they have one spark of gratitude, they will not willingly plunge a people into civil war, who held out to them the friendly hand of assistance in that hour of dark distress, when there was few to say, God save them. We can only say to them, if they still persist in the blind course they have heretofore followed in flooding the country with their people, that we fear and firmly believe that an immediate civil war is the inevitable consequence. We know that there is not one among us who thirsts for the blood of that people. Now comes this very important paragraph, which I recommend to your special attention, because I think it is a very magnanimous and very rare statement. We do not contend that we have the least right under the constitution and laws of the country to expel them by force. I think that's a great sentence. I would like you to take that down. That a meeting that is bent on destroying the Mormon settlement admits this, you see. We do not contend that we have the least right under the constitution and laws of the country to expel them by force. That I think is a very general sentence. But we would indeed be blind. You got it? We do not contend that we have the least right under the constitution and laws of the country to expel the Mormons by force. If this would induce you to look behind legality and beneath legality in the all important issues of life, you would then see that second legality is always second rate. That it is important that we must live, of course, try to live by law, but that the greater passions of mankind will always say, yes, maybe the law, but that isn't the whole story. You cannot live by the law in the Christian era. That's what Christianity means. But we would indeed be blind if we did not foresee that the first blow that is struck at this moment of dear excitement must and will speedily involve every individual in a war, bearing ruin, woe, and desolation in its course. It matters but little how, where, or by whom the war may begin. When the world of destruction commences, we must all be borne onward by the storm or crushed beneath its fury. In a civil war, when our homes are the theater on which it is fought, there can be no neutrals. Let our opinion be what they may, we must fight in self-defense. That's, of course, as a tragedy, you see, when war is declared, there are no five and six parties, there are only two. Solon, the great hero of Athenian legislation, legislated as his last law when he left the city that in a civil war, every citizen had to take sides. There could be no neutrals. Very strange. We want nothing, we ask nothing. We could have nothing from these people. We only ask them for their own safety and for ours to take the least of the two evils. So this again is a very instructive things. These good people, these secular people who say we have no, not the same faith as these other people, have as their last insight, the very important insight, which you must learn, because it's the difference between secular government and religious order, that government is always the choice between two evils, and is always the choice of the lesser evil. Governments are not there to be daddies or mothers, let alone sugar daddies, and they are not there for philanthropical purposes. They are there for the minimum of order and law. And therefore, in secular order, the choice is always between the lesser evil of legislating, which is always an evil. One more law is always worse than no law. And this is forgotten today. Our legislation manufacture laws, they cannot be obeyed. 5,000 laws a year, that's just nothing. That undermines the authority of the Congress today, that they have to legislate far too many things. Laws must be parsimonious, they must be few, because every law is an evil. But it is a lesser evil to not passing the law. And Calvin Coolidge, the strange president who never said anything, as you know, and nobody knows whether he had anything to say. Although he did translate Dante. He used to say, when a law came to him for a signed signature, he said, is it necessary? And he would not sign a superfluous law. And I think there was great wisdom in this one remark, is it necessary? Our modern society is so foolhardy, being completely secular, that you think the only thing society can do is pass laws. And then there are blue laws, become blue laws, and never observed. And the fewer the laws, the better the society obviously is off. You can only understand this if you do not impart to the processes of the secular sphere religious fervor and sanctity. If you say that this is a saint business, the business of saints to be in Congress, then you must, of course, think that a law has the qualities of a religious, you see, conviction. And then it is not an evil in itself, because religion is, after all, an attempt to do the holy things, the wholesome things, the things that express health. But all government interference expresses concern with sickness, with evil. And therefore, that you have to pass a law is already a symptom that something is wrong, that this country is not held together by a common faith, but only by necessity, by a law, as we call this. And so, I think this sentence again deserves to be picked up, written in the year 1836, because I think this is the true American mistrust of central government, which expresses itself here. That is, they knew at that time, still in the presence of the churches and the gospel, that legislation was a second-rate thing. In the modern masses, you are no longer in persons. You are just, as I said, wards of some institution. You quote the institution to which you belong in order to identify yourself. You say, I'm UCLA. And I told you that I think that's a poor reference. Because all these references, that I am General Motors and I'm General Electric, you see, this means that I no longer have the courage, as Mr. Smith, to be somebody in my own right. And so, with these modern men, legislation seems to you so exalted that you are even still voters, that you are still in the political process, treated as persons, that you do not want to have this perspective that it's the social process is making you very small indeed, what I would call subnormal. And if in the normal process of secular government you deal with politics and laws, here we deal with rules and regulations. But in religion we deal with divine commands. That's something quite different. There is in a command
of religious fervor, there is no separation between legislator and obedient, citizen. They are not split. In the command, I'm king myself. I'm king ruled out and ruled. And this has completely disappeared from the American thinking. If you are in modern education and modern psychology manuals, the difference between a command, a law, and a rule is lost sight of. You have to drive on the street and have to keep right. That's a rule of social behavior. The beehive has to be regulated. That's not a law in the sense of in which Congress should pass laws, you see. To keep right is a rule of behaviorism. You are not asked what you think about this law. You aren't even asked beforehand what law you would prefer. You see, the city ordinance has to be passed because otherwise we get accidents on the road. You see, that's a very minor thing. For my personality, it has nothing to do with that. I have to keep on the right of the road. It's treating me as a part of a general process of floating traffic. As soon as this is lost sight of, you will not understand the agony of these good people here. What happens to this secular group of the committee in Missouri? They are faced with a religious march stream, with a religious onrush, these Mormons. Fanatics, certainly, you see, increasing every day, a flood. They're living under a command that ends finally with the candidacy of Joseph Smith for the presidency of the United States, by the way. In 1944, he was on the ticket for the presidency of the United States. So it is unlimited, as all commands are. And there, and this is so important, in a negative way, these good people discover their own religion. If you want to speak to people who are acting under a divine command, of course you cannot break their will by a secular law. And so they see in your humility, and they discover it as they go along, and that's why I think this document is of primary importance in American history. Here are decent people who have tried to leave each other alone and not to talk religion to each other, but talk on the affairs of the marketplace and to cope with each other under the laws of the country. Here in comes this fanatic group, and these people are forced in dialectical answer to discover, so to speak, to state their own religious principles. That's always will happen. A new group always forces the people of old to get together and formulate their principles. The Christians today, because of the communist onslaught, suddenly must state general principles of Christianity. The ecumenic movement is an attempt to this. As you see it, even the Pope has to fall in with this. He's just forced as an antidote against communism to become generally Christian. Well, this is a quotation, sir. I once wrote a book on this fact on revolutions, and when my friends in Boston talked about it to a Frenchman who comes from a country where you are either an atheist or a Roman Catholic and there is nothing third in between, you know, he said, what's this man thinking? What's he believing? Ah, he said after a time, c'est généralement chrétien. And he discovered, you see, this in general, in America, this is nothing new, that we have to be in general Christians, you see. But in France, it was a complete discovery that somebody could have point de vue généralement chrétien. Now, this is what these people are forced to discover. And as to the dialectics of any religious life in any country, you can put it down that secular groups, under the onslaught of a religious or quasi-religious movement, are forced to become religious themselves. This is what happens at this moment in this country, and it is so very difficult to understand that it is at this time purely a dialectical compulsion to meet these people on the ground on which they seem to be invincible. Because no secular statement will hold out against a religious command. We want nothing. All these are religious statements, you see.
We want nothing, we ask nothing, we would have nothing from these people. We only ask them for their own safety and for ours, that takes the least of the two evils. Most of them are destitute of land, have but little property, are late emigrants to this country without relations, friends, or enduring ties to bind them to this land. It is interesting that the thinking of America in this moment in 1836 is still so European that these people are not called immigrants but emigrants. Because emigrant is a name that only makes sense in Europe. Immigrant is a term that only makes sense here. And everybody here speaks today of the immigrant, of immigration. But in 1836, all these people had still so much in the European head that they, so to speak, obediently called as the people who came newly, emigrants. At the risk of such imminent peril to them and to us, we request them to leave us when their crops are gathered, their business settled, and they have made every suitable preparation to remove. Those who have 40 acres of land, we are willing should remain until they can dispose of it without loss, if it should require years. But we urge, most strongly urge, that immigration cease, and cease immediately, as nothing else can or will allay for a moment the deep excitement that is now unhappily agitating this community. If the Mormons will comply with these friendly requisitions, we will use every exertion among our citizens to arrest this evil before it is forever too late, but if they are disregarded, we can promise that neither them nor ourselves a long continuation of the blessings of peace and harmony. Now comes the resolutions. The religion, then, of a people that are driven to defense are as to the brotherhood of the moment with the enemy. They are at this moment religiously minded because they go beyond the necessity of the law in admonishing these people, in warning them against war. So it is very touching that the antagonism, the dialectical no to a new religious movement must always take the form of immediate Marshall Plan help. The Marshall Plan is a typical assertion of a religious conviction of the solidarity, you see, of the human race, because it was offered to the Russians too, you see, this help. At a moment when we cannot agree on the lasting commands of living together. And therefore, you must not think that the behavior of this little group in Missouri County has no significance for you and me. Whenever you get are up against such a fanaticism, you must reassert that part of religion which already ties you together with the men of the other command. He can indulge, so to speak, in following his articulate command, whatever that may be, you see. You are forced to convince him that he already shares some religion with you. And so you have to open up your hearts and your arms in a way you would never have done it before. I think that makes all the racial issues at this moment in the United States so very urgent and so very different from what they were before. And it is, of course, also true about our social order. So I thought you should receive this document with a feeling that this is only a sampling of something eternal. The Mormons had to leave Illinois after the death of Joseph Smith, and they were now became a nationwide religion in this sense, that when they moved across the country into Salt Lake City and its neighboring territories, they first had to serve in the Army of the United States government. That is, the Civil War came around and they were, no, it was the Mexican War, partly the Mexican War. In the Mexican War, they had to immediately furnish soldiers. And the governor was very severe on them and said, if you do not send your young men serving with us in the war, we will not allow you to pass. And here you have then this crucial moment in which a religious movement, which still tried to believe in the single covenant community, was made a part of the nation's history, because at that moment, you see, the general war, the Mexican War,
fell upon them as parts of the larger American community. And I tried to, I said in the beginning that the religious movement of the 19th century had to accomplish this very difficult task to change from a local covenantal church like the Amishmen in Pennsylvania or the Moravian Brother to a nationwide religion, as we see the Mormons today displaying their power over the whole of the United States. So the migration into a new territory from Illinois produced this effect that they now became part and parcel of the universal American history, and no longer were a church in the wilderness. This transition from the naive idea of a new Jerusalem in one spot to the growing into the size of a nationwide movement is also expressed by the necessity of putting missionaries into work. The covenanted community of the Congregationalists did not have any feeling of mission. The Congregationalism was very poor at missions in the 18th century, 17th, except, as a matter of fact, it had not. And it's a very belated development that they went out and in for missions. They were self-satisfying, and if they colonized, simply people from their own town would go and settle the other town. That's not mission, because they didn't convert any outsider to their religion. Now, Christianity in this country, if it wanted to be become nationwide, any groups of Mormons have to be missionaries. And the transformation of the Mormon in Utah to the most likely missionary society we have at this moment in this country is therefore a part and parcel of their problem to create this congruity, this identity between their religion and the religion of America. Because mission means faith. Mission means expectation. It isn't necessary that everybody is converted now, but as long as you send out one missionary to Africa, you still believe in Christianity, that it is a true religion. Otherwise, you don't. And there are therefore two consequences which I would like you to bear in mind, because we are faced today with a complete death of this faith in the future of Christianity. One, that every Christian must make one convert, or he is not a Christian. That Christianity without conversion is dead. Because the works of Christianity are faith, the spreading of the faith, the fruitfulness of the faith, not works, nothing external, but another Christian. Whether you bring up your children in a Christian church, that's one way, a very cheap way, or whether you convert your best friend, or whether you insist that in your marriage, husband and wife must have the same faith, or at least gain gradually the same faith, it's all the same. The problem is that there is no religious command upon you if you do not identify your brother with yourself. Now, the preaching of the gospel may not be the best way of converting somebody. You may be silent, but that's a conversion too. The famous story of the missionary who lived among the Eskimos for 16 years. And after 16 years, one Eskimo opened his mouth finally and said, "Tell me, who was this man Jesus?" So it had taken him 16 years, you see, to get the Eskimo to ask any question. And of course, you cannot teach anybody who isn't asking the question, and you cannot convert anybody who is not expecting, asking you to give him advice. And unwanted advice is no advice. It's worse than advice, no advice. It's never taken. If you advise somebody who hasn't asked you to give the advice, you only make an enemy. The second point about missions, our oil companies, the Aramco Oil Company in Arabia, is now flying over their camps the green flag of Allah and His Prophet. And it reads, "Allah is great and Muhammad is His Prophet, there is Prophet." Now these people are, of course, writing off our whole history and our whole civilization.
and that this is the same people, as you know, who are not allowed to have a Christian service in Saudi Arabia on Sundays, and who are not allowed to land a Jewish officer of the Navy on the shores of Saudi Arabia. So we have three applications of our faith in one act, so to speak, in our relations to this gentleman, pirate king, Ibn Saud of Arabia. This is important, that because the second law of grace is that if you don't care to state your faith, if you have given up, you will be forced to confess another faith. In religion, there is no neutrality possible. You cannot evade it. If you say, I am nobody, you are somebody. But you are somebody else's somebody. This flag of Allah and the Prophet is, after all, a catastrophical surrender to Islam. It is not neutral. And the American tradition at this moment of a purely secular society is that there is such a thing in the highest order of life of neutrality. There is no neutral. You cannot be neutral in questions of marriage, in question of children, in question of peace, in question of war. As these people say, you are forced, under the import of the command of somebody else, to say under whose command you are acting. And so Aramco is acting obviously there under the commands of lie, cowardice, and greed. That's a religion too, but it's an anti-religion. Now we come to the second movement. Oh, in 1889, the Supreme Court of the United States was faced with the fact that the Mormons by that time had spread, had established statehood in territory in Utah, and now claimed that they had a right to become a state in the Union. It was denied to them because there was still polygamy. And before the United States came the great question whether the territory of Utah could become a state unless polygamy was uprooted. I think this case is not often quoted, and again I feel the document is worth your while. It is to be found in the United States reports of the cases adjudged in the Supreme Court at the October term of 1889. And if anybody wants to use it for his doctor's dissertation, it is in volume 136 of these, you see, bulging decisions of the Supreme Court. It's a long decision, and I wish some of you would go into it, because it is not for lawyers. It's written for historians, it's written for churchmen. We have only to deal with the interesting statement that the United States government is what I would call a post-Christian government, that it cannot go back on the standards of a Christian country, although it is a secular government. And in order to understand then secularism in this country, you must always know that it cannot go behind that which was already implied in the religious settlement of this country. It is distinctly stated in the pleadings and finding of fact that the property of the Mormon Church was held for the purpose of religious and charitable uses. So that would free them, you see, from interference, because religious and charitable uses, as you know, to this day, are not even taxed. And one way of getting rid of your income tax is, of course, to give it to religious and charitable users. But it is also stated, the court says, in the findings of fact, and it is a matter of public notoriety, that the religious and charitable uses intended to be subserved and promoted are the inculcation and spread of the doctrines and usages of the Mormon Church, or Church of Latter-day Saints, one of the distinguishing features of which is the practice of polygamy, a crime against the laws and abhorrent to the sentiments and feelings of the civilized world. Notwithstanding the stringent laws which have been passed by Congress
notwithstanding all the efforts made to suppress this barbarous practice, will you kindly take down these words, abhorrent to the sentiments and feelings of the civilized world, and barbarous practice. So we have two expressions, it's not civilized and it is barbarous. The sect or community composing the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints perseveres in defiance of law, in preaching, upholding, promoting, and defending it. It is a matter of public notoriety that its emissaries are engaged in many countries in propagating this nefarious doctrine and urging its converts to join the community in Utah. The existence of such a propaganda is a blot on our civilization. The organization of a community for the spread and practice of polygamy, you now have a paper for homosexuals on this campus, is in a measure a return to barbarism. It is contrary to the spirit of Christianity and of the civilization which Christianity has produced in the Western world. One pretense for this obstinate course is that their belief in the practice of polygamy or in the right to indulge in it is a religious belief, and therefore under the what I call a command, under the protection of the constitutional guarantee of religious freedom. Here we come to an important point. This is, of course, very important for you today just as well. This is altogether a sophistical plea. No doubt the thugs of India imagine that their belief in the right of assassination was a religious belief, that their thinking so did not make it so. The practice of sati, that the widows are burned, by the Hindu widows may have sprung from a supposed religious conviction. The offering of human sacrifices by our own ancestors in Britain was no doubt sanctioned by an equally conscientious impulse, but no one on that account would hesitate to brand these practices now as crimes against society and obnoxious to condemnation and punishment by the civil authority. The state has a perfect right to prohibit polygamy and all other open offenses against the enlightened sentiment of mankind. And I'm very glad to read here the word of mankind, which shows the solidarity, you see, of the law of the 18th, 19th century in America with the laws of the human race, notwithstanding the pretense of religious conviction by which they may be advocated and practiced. I think that's enough for our own purposes. But then it goes, there's one more sentence. The principle of the law of charities are not confined to a particular people or nation, but prevail in all civilized countries pervaded by the spirit of Christianity. I tried to show you in 1776 that the flag with its Egyptian stars, these five-pointed stars instead of the Star of David with six points, that the dollar bill, you see, that the pursuit of happiness instead of salvation, that all these have been secular translations of the common denominator in the religious traditions of the preceding 1700 years. We have here, in the year 110 years later after the Constitution, or just 100 years after the Constitution was passed, is the same expression of the firm belief of the Supreme Court that the country, civilized countries, are simply countries permeated by the spirit of Christianity. And you will not understand the term civilized nations if you do not understand that it means Christianized peoples without regard to their denomination. It doesn't mean Roman Catholic, it doesn't mean Greek Catholic, but it means Christianized. And I think for our future it is terribly important that you should bear in mind that in this sense the Russians belong to the same tradition. They are not Asiatic people, as some chief commentators dare to say. They are certainly in the 19th century have produced greater Christians than anyone in the West, like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and many others, by the way. And you are in great danger today, because you live in a completely secularized society in which you want to run nations by factories and education, and by law only, that We have a tradition on a much wider scale that from the Ural or from Siberia to Los Angeles, which permeates what we call civilized state. Saudi Arabia is not a civilized state for this very reason. And but we treat at this moment Saudi Arabia as a civilized state, as you know. Mr. Eichner went to the airport to receive him sound. He did not receive Mikoyan in the airport. Thank you.